We have three readings today, and the first reading is Nehemiah chapter 5, verses 1 to 9. Now the men and their wives raised a great outcry against their fellow Jews. Some were saying, "We and our sons and daughters are numerous. In order for us to eat and stay alive, we must get grain." Others were saying, "We are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our homes to get grain during the famine." Still, others were saying, "We have had to borrow money to pay the king's tax on our fields and vineyards. Although we are of the same flesh and blood as our fellow Jews, and though our children are as good as theirs, yet we have to subject our sons and daughters to slavery. Some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but we are powerless because our fields and our vineyards belong to others." When I heard their outcry and these charges, I was very angry. I pondered them in my mind and then accused the nobles and officials. I told them, "You are charging your own people interest." So I called together a large meeting to deal with them and said, "As far as possible, we have brought back our fellow Jews who were sold to the Gentiles. Now you are selling your own people, only for them to be sold back to us." They kept quiet because they could find nothing to say. So I continued, "What you are doing is not right. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God to avoid the reproach of our Gentile enemies?" The second reading is Nehemiah chapter 6, verses 1 to 9. When word came to Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arab, and the rest of our enemies that I had rebuilt the wall and not a gap was left in it, though up to that time I had not set the walls in the gates, Sanballat and Geshem sent me this message: "Come, let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono." But they were scheming to harm me. So I sent messengers to them with this reply: "I am carrying on a great project and cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you?" Four times they sent me the same message, and each time I gave them the same answer. Then the fifth time, Sanballat sent his assistant to me with the same message, and in his hand was an unsealed letter in which was written, "It is reported among the nations, and Geshem says it is true, that you and the Jews are plotting to revolt, and therefore you are building the wall. Moreover, according to these reports, you are about to become their king, and I've even appointed prophets to make this proclamation about New Jerusalem. There is a king in Judah. Now this report will get back to the king, so come, let us meet together." I sent him this reply: "Nothing like what you are saying is happening. You are just making it up out of your head." They were all trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak for the work and it will not be completed. And the final reading is Nehemiah chapter 6, verse 15 through to chapter 7, verse 3. So the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul, in 52 days. When all our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence because they believed that this work had been done with the help of our God. Also in those days, the nobles of Judah were sending many letters to Tobiah, and replies from Tobiah kept coming to them. For many in Judah were under oath to him, since he was son-in-law to Shechaniah, son of Arah, and his son Jehohanan had married a daughter of Meshullam, son of Berechiah. Moreover, they kept reporting to me his good deeds and then telling him what I said. And Tobiah sent letters to intimidate me. After the wall had been rebuilt and I had set the doors in place, the gatekeepers, the musicians, and the Levites were appointed. I put in charge of Jerusalem my brother Hanani, along with Hananiah, the commander of the citadel, because he was a man of integrity and feared God more than most people do. I said to him, "The gates of Jerusalem are not to be opened until the sun is hot. While the gatekeepers are still on duty, make them shut the doors and bar them. Also appoint residents of Jerusalem as guards, some at their posts and some near their own houses."
Thank you so much for reading there for us and for Rose's leadership of our time together. My name is Chris Wigram. I'm in charge of the leadership team here at Fairfield, and I want to wish you all a welcome this morning, especially if you're joining us from another part of the area or even further afield. We're continuing our studies in Nehemiah, and I was wondering the question at the beginning of the service is something like this: what kind of success have you had in your life? Maybe you felt over the moon about getting a particular job or passing a particular exam. Maybe it was some athletic achievement or reaching some kind of personal milestone. And all of us may have experienced these moments of accomplishment and joy that come with success. And we've been learning about the work that Nehemiah had in rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. And in our passage today, we find a peak, a time of real success. Nehemiah 6:15. So the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul in 52 days. Nehemiah achieved what he set out to do, but it was not without cost, as we're going to see. Now we're looking at three chapters this morning, and I've divided them really into these headings. The enemy within is chapter 5. The enemy without is chapter 6, and the administration for all is chapter 7. So firstly, let's look at the enemy within, verses 1 to 13. Have you heard the phrase, "We're all in this together," recently? If you've been listening to reports from India of the COVID outbreaks there, a number of people have commented, they've said, this is a VIP society. Have you heard that phrase in relation to India? Which means that those with influence and privilege get dealt with before the poor and the outcast. If you listen to political discourse or general discussion, there is always on the part of human beings a yearning for unity. We're told that things like football can bring people together, or the Olympic Games. And it is a yearning of our hearts for us to be united with one another, but it's often bedeviled by our own desire to look after myself first before thinking of other people. Now, I just said that the building of the walls of Jerusalem was a success, but it cost Nehemiah something. And here we find out what it is. Because Nehemiah in chapter 5 is faced with a crisis that stops the work and needs to be dealt with, and it's a crisis that involves morale and motivation. Firstly, he describes the act and identifies what is wrong in verses 6 to 8. And it says something in verse 6. He said, Nehemiah was angry. How do you react to that? There are definitely some things that leaders need to be angry about. Think of Moses coming down the mountain when the people were worshipping the golden calf. But the other thing about Nehemiah was that he was also self-controlled. He consulted with himself, if you like. You could say he reflected, or the word here in our text is the word pondered. And here we have something of the heart of Nehemiah, because he is angry, but he's angry for God's glory, because it's directed against injustice. And it's an anger that is inspired by the Holy Spirit, but not an anger that should be prolonged, because as Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, anyone who is angry with his brother will be subject to judgment. So this is not a prolonged anger against somebody. This is the anger of a leader whose heart is motivated by the glory of God and what should be done. And because he was angry, he took action. He confronted the nobles and the officials with the problem. What were they doing? They were charging interest to their own people. Influences within the Jewish community were exploiting everyone else, and this was leading to major problems within the people of God. What was the point of rebuilding Jerusalem if economic practice was to remain the same? Look at 5 verse 1. Now the men and their wives raised a great outcry against their Jewish brothers. You could say, what's the point of us rebuilding after the COVID crisis is everything remains the same? We've heard that. We've already had Build Back Better. And that's something that people yearn for in their hearts. And there's a great outcry, which has been made worse by the famine, because the people are being exploited. And Nehemiah is prepared to confront them. Someone said the problem really arose because of indifference to the work of God by greedy, selfish leaders. See, people are finding it hard to feed their families. They're having to go into debt in order to do so. Others were having a problem that was akin to slavery, as people lost the land or the vineyard when they were unable to pay their taxes. And to make it worse, it was being exacerbated by the leaders of the community, people who were allowing this to happen. This was a crisis for Nehemiah. The people are hurting. And it shows very clearly that reform needs to take into consideration the whole picture. Remember, too, that we're not just dealing with an ordinary people. We're dealing with the people of God in the Old Testament here. And behind these complaints, there is the covenant that God made with the people about giving them the land. God had provided in Leviticus 25, and we'll hear more about that later in the summer, a jubilee to make sure that this kind of exploitation could not happen. But a long time had passed, the people had gone into exile, and they had forgotten why they were there in the first place as the people of God. One can understand that exile had made a huge impact on the national psyche. The Jews had forfeited their means of production, the land, and some were hopelessly in debt, verse 5. So what does Nehemiah do as a leader? Well, he names the nightmare. And he says to the leaders, you are exploiting the people of God. Look at what he says in verse 8. Now you are selling your brothers only for them to be sold back to us. What's he saying? These people have been ransomed from exile, if you like. They've come back from exile. So having ransomed them once, they now need to ransom all over again. This is ridiculous. This shouldn't be happening. What was the response? Very interesting. Verse 8. They kept quiet because they could find nothing to say. Silence was the response. And as I said earlier, we're talking about the people of God in the Old Testament here. And Nehemiah asserts a covenant alternative. He tells them that they are not acting in the fear of the Lord. And worse still, by not acting in the fear of the Lord, they are giving the Gentiles ammunition as to the kind of society they are building. If you look in verse 9, what you are doing is not right. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of God to avoid the reproach of our Gentile enemies? How many times did that come up in the Old Testament? You are being looked at as the people of God. People are looking at you, and you're just doing what the world is doing. There's no difference between you and the world whatsoever. And that's Nehemiah's complaint here. He says, look, you're no different to anybody else. And as you go on through the text, you will find that Nehemiah and other leaders were helping out other people with money and food. But according to verse 10, they were not charging interest. He urges them to return all that they have appropriated and also the interest that has been paid in verse 11. So Nehemiah institutes a kind of reform program, and the people respond in verse 12. They said, we'll give it back and we won't demand anything more from them. We will do as you say. So Nehemiah gets them to swear an oath that they will actually do this, and then he gives them a visual aid. Right in front of them there, he shakes out the folds of his robes as a sign of what will happen to those who do not repair the damage in verse 13. This idea of shaking was used in the description of the victory over the Egyptians at the Red Sea in the Exodus. God will shake up arrangements that do not honor God's will for the community. Fortunately, here the people all agreed to this way, and the people move forward. Now, this raises an interesting question for us. If we have some money and the opportunity to use it, don't we have a right to get an income from the assets we've invested and to take some kind of compensation? Surely, if others cannot manage their own affairs and they get themselves into debt, that's their fault. How else can the world keep going? Well, Nehemiah admits his own involvement. verse 10. He didn't claim his expenses. And up until the Reformation, the church held that it was wrong to charge interest. And this is a key point about the book of Nehemiah that we've been discussing. Although many people have used the book to teach about things like leadership skills, project management, or building programs, the main point of Nehemiah is that we are talking about the people of God. The point is here that we have God's people engaged in a program, building the kingdom, if you like, that needs every hand on deck. The last thing they need is distractions. The last thing they need is distractions caused by other people in the body. And they do need to remember that the land is a gift from God. And talking about this whole question of interest, if you look into church history and into the recent lives, say, of many brethren leaders, and brethren were people who helped to found this church, you will find that many church leaders gave interest-free loans for a whole plethora of Christian ministries, building churches like this one, but other ministries too, where people gave interest-free loans in order to advance the kingdom. And so I think what we need to learn from this is that, firstly, believers do not exploit other believers. And Jesus emphasized that in the New Testament, because he said, referring to the disciples, whatever you did, talking about giving a glass of cold water, whatever you did for one of the least of these, you did it for me. You might say, well, I'm not exploiting anybody. I haven't got any assets to exploit people. But Jesus brings it right down to that simple act of giving a cup of cold water. Interesting question. Why were the people willing to listen to Nehemiah? I remember a few months ago seeing a photo of the German Chancellor Angela Merkel walking to the supermarket with her husband in an outfit that a fashion editor noticed that she'd worn 10 years previously. Apparently the lad do that. Don't know why. The writer remarked, here we have a world leader who lives modestly, pays her taxes to the state, does not demand things from her people, and works for their best interest. Well, Nehemiah was also such a man, as verses 14 to 19 show us, because this verse that's up on the board there in a part we didn't read says, the earlier governors, those preceding Nehemiah, placed a heavy burden on the people and took 40 shekels of silver from them, in addition to food and wine. Their assistants also lorded it over the people. But out of reverence for God, I did not act like that. He was intent on not placing heavy burdens on the people, so he didn't eat the allocated food. Why not? Out of the fear of God. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Here we see it applied in the life of Nehemiah. Instead, they focused on the task of building the wall. But that doesn't mean to say that Nehemiah wasn't hospitable. Verse 18 tells us he was hospitable as a leader as he needed to be. But he didn't overdo his privilege. Brothers and sisters, how many countries in the world would benefit from a leader who did not overdo their privilege? How many? Probably 3/4 of them. Instead of salting away money in Swiss bank accounts and exploiting the peoples of the different countries that they work with, if people had this attitude, it would make a huge difference in the world in which we live. And what does he do? Well, he ends with a prayer asking for the grace of God in verse 19 of chapter 5. Remember me with favor, that word favor, grace, oh my God, for all I have done for these people. And Nehemiah, by doing that, by being a man of grace, deals with the enemy within. But he also has the enemy without. This is chapter 6. You don't achieve much for God without experience some opposition, and we've seen some of these characters already in the story. As I said earlier, people are watching, people are listening, and they are plotting to distract Nehemiah from the main event. What is that? The main event is to complete the wall, and according to verse 1 of chapter 6, there are still doors to be hung. So what do his opponents suggest? Well, often opponents will use devious tactics of those who hate God. And the opposition from Sanballat and Tobias and Geshem, which Brian introduced us to so well last week, comes in a three-pronged attack. And the first one is the strategy is to ask Nehemiah to leave the land so he can have a discussion with them. What they're wanting him to do is to leave his job and to go into what is enemy territory in order for us to have a discussion with him. However, Nehemiah was aware of their schemes, and despite their insistence, he refused to be distracted from his work. Nehemiah responds to the deception, and he says to them, "The place you've suggested is the wrong place. It's enemy territory. The people you want me to meet with are the wrong people, opponents of Israel, and the time is not right because the doors need to be hung." But they don't give up. Verse 4, they hassle him four times. Talk about insistence. When that doesn't work, they send a letter full of fake news. Verse 5, this was the imperial threat, and it worked once before because 20 years earlier, when Artaxerxes banned the project, there was some kind of cessation of the work that Nehemiah and the people were doing. They accused Nehemiah of building the wall for his own benefit and to rebel against the local authorities. So they're basically getting political here. They actually, in verse 6, accuse him of having the aspirations to become a king, and not just a king, but one who has appointed prophets who are going to justify that he is to be king. So it's going to be theological. He's going to be appointed as a king by the prophets. And those words of the prophets will endorse his position as king. And Sanballat, bless his heart, offers himself as a media, just in case the authorities hear about all this. You see that in verse 7. Again, what does Nehemiah do? Well, he's very firm. He just says, stop talking rubbish. He realizes that this is a campaign of intimidation that hopes to weaken their resolve. But Nehemiah has a response. What is that response? Well, in verse 9, it is a prayer. His prayer is one of those, you know, we mentioned in, I think when David was preaching, we talked about the arrow prayer that he had in Nehemiah 1. We get another one of those here. He says, in the midst of this conflict, but I prayed, verse 9, now strengthen my hands. And he needs God's strength because the assault is continuing, because now we get the false prophet. He needs this prayer for strength because the false prophet has come. When he needs love, encouragement, and support, he seems to be paying some kind of pastoral visit to Semaiah, who urges Nehemiah to lock himself in the temple because there are threats to kill him. Verse 11. Well, is Nehemiah a priest? No, he isn't. So he certainly shouldn't go and lock himself in the temple. And also, we see that Nehemiah shows a lot of discernment here. For in verse 12, he says, I realized that God not had sent him, but they had prophesied against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. Here you have the hired hand, the hired prophet, who was trying to distract Nehemiah from the work of God. And it reminds us that discernment is something we need continually, because not everything in the Christian world in which we live is good. There are prophets for hire, there are false teachers. And this man has been hired by Nehemiah's enemies. We do have enemies. And once again, what is Nehemiah's response? It's another prayer in verse 14. He says, oh my God, because of what they have done, remember also the prophetess Noadiah and the rest of the prophets who have been trying to intimidate me. So what does he do? He prays for his enemies. Now, we've seen that this was a successful effort because the wall was completed in record time. And his enemies realize that something supernatural has happened here. And did you notice what it says in the text? This is the most brilliant. This is the gospel in Nehemiah. Can you preach the gospel from the Old Testament? Of course you can. What does it say? It says, so the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul in 52 days. When all our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence because they realized that this work had been done with the help of our God. That is a classic statement of the gospel, that when God works, everybody loses their self-confidence. When Jesus Christ comes into life and saves you, all of your self-confidence is evaporating because you have nothing to bring. And when people see God is working, Then they realize they cannot stand against him. Their self-confidence goes. There's no hand. It's one of the Psalms, you know, no hand or no arm formed against me will succeed. Because that's who the living God is. And so you hear the gospel in Nehemiah. They lose their self-confidence. And against the odds, Nehemiah and his team have begun rebuilding Jerusalem. And with everything against them, they still succeeded because God was with them. And even now, some of the nobles of Judah, Tobiah, who we saw was a major pest last week, they were keeping in touch with Tobiah and the other nobles there in Judah. And they were reporting about, I call this the enemy without, but he's still got the enemy within, because Tobiah is a Jew. And he's still causing problems, more conspiracy from the enemy within. But what I want to say, brothers and sisters, is what Nehemiah tells us here is that when God works, nothing can stand against him. Our self-confidence, the idea, you know, you think to yourself, where do you get the idea of Christian celebrity from? Because the moment God works and does something in your life, that brings you to a point of humility and prayer. It doesn't bring you to a point of exaltation of yourself. And yet all around us in the Christian world, we have people who are exalting themselves, left, right, and center. That should not be so, brothers and sisters. We have nothing to be exalted in except for the Lord Jesus Christ. Whatever gifts you've been given, they're being given to you. They're gifts, gifts, gifts. You didn't develop them. They're gifts, as is our salvation. So finally, shortly, the administration for all. Someone commenting on leadership said, no one is fit to lead his fellows unless he holds their care and well-being to be his prime responsibility, his duty, his privilege. Now, next week, we're having our service for Paul, and we will be commissioning him as the leader of this church. And that's exactly what we're looking for, someone who is going to be the servant leader amongst us, who doesn't exalt themselves, but puts God first and sees God working in our midst. That's what we're praying for. That's what we'll be emphasizing next week. And the building of the wall here in Nehemiah was just one small part of the project, because we knew that Nehemiah was concerned with the state of the people under exile, and he's wanting to rebuild a community under the covenant of God. And now that the walls are built, you see, you've got to organize your society. That's why we organize this church. We can't just have a random church. We have to actually be organized. And Nehemiah needed to be organized as well. Sometimes when I was with OMF International, we used to talk about 8 strategic priorities concerning ministry in Asia. But when I used to speak to them, I always added a 9th. And that was, who and where will we find the administrators and the IT people and the bookkeepers and the mechanics and those other people who will be able to make these 8 visions happen? Because without them, it won't happen. And he has to do a number of things. He needs the mayor of Jerusalem, even in verse 1. See what he says about the mayor of Jerusalem. He says he was a man of integrity and knew the fear of God. So there Nehemiah is appointing people into leadership, people who have that fear of God. That's what he's looking for when he looks for a leader. Do they have the fear of God in their hearts? Because this man was then what he was in public is what he was in private. And they have to rebuild the community, because even though they've managed to get the walls up, there's still practical need for security in verse 3 of chapter 7. And also the place was needing to be inhabited. It was such a spaced out place where people had been prioritizing building the walls, hadn't really been building their houses. And anyway, many of them lived in some of the villages of Judah and other areas round about them. So what he needed to do was to get a genealogy together, a record of the people. Now most of chapter 7 is a genealogy. And it's really like a census, a record of all the people who came back. And he wants to find out exactly who is there as the people of God. And it's a long genealogy, and we don't normally read genealogies when we're in church together, because we think they're not important. They're absolutely critical. Genealogies are critical in the Bible because they record the people of God. Never forget that. But we don't read them because we're not used to that sort of thing. But Nehemiah records them. These are the ones who returned from exile. Now think about that for a moment. They had no hope. They had possibly a very bleak future. For those people, and it was 50,000 altogether, the priests, the Levites, the temple singers, the gatekeepers, the temple servants, and many, many more people, 50,000 people, what did they do? When they saw what needed to be done, they moved by faith and moved back to Jerusalem in order to help. Nehemiah rebuild the temple. And then what did they do? You see, once he got all the people back into Jerusalem, that's good. But once the administration was complete, what was needed? What do the people of God need? They need the Word of God. And that, brothers and sisters, is the subject in 2 weeks' time. Amen.